So our next talk is by Alex Filipenko on the diversity of supernovae.
Core collapse supernovae.
Core collapse supernovae, thank you.
You told me not to talk about the other ones.
You're not allowed to talk about type 1A, sorry.
I will, a little tiny bit, although they're not core collapse, just because some of the progenitors for type 1As might lead to neutron stars, which are of interest to this group, but I won't say much about them. Okay, so yeah, Lars asked me as part of this setting the stage process to talk about the observed diversity of events that are believed to result in the core collapse and the formation of a compact object. So there's sort of a brief outline of what I'll discuss in the short time available. And if there are things on this list that I don't get to, you're welcome to ask me in the Q&A session. And those who want to know more about the optical spectra of supernovae, I've put a whole big stack of reprints of this annual reviews article out on the table there near the registration desk. Okay, so observationally, we classify supernovae from their optical spectra. And basically, type 1 means it doesn't have any hydrogen, looks like a roller coaster, and has a whole bunch of other things, mostly intermediate mass elements at early times. And these are the most luminous supernovae. And the type 2s are the ones that do have hydrogen, all right? And the ones which have been conventionally associated with core collapse. As I will discuss today, and as most of you already know, we now think that the peculiar type 1s, the so-called type 1Bs and 1Cs, are also core collapse events, and I'll give you the evidence for that as a major part of this talk. The type 1Bs don't have hydrogen, just like is required by the definition, but they also don't have the defining characteristic of the classical type 1As, this red line of singly ionized silicon. So they don't have that. Instead, they have helium lines. And the type 1Cs have neither the silicon line nor the helium lines. They have oxygen, calcium, and other stuff. So those are the observational distinctions. 1B has helium, no silicon. 1C has neither helium nor silicon. And it's still debatable, perhaps, whether in 1Cs the helium is truly absent or whether it's there and simply not being excited. I'll give you some evidence in favor of the hypothesis that the 1Cs really truly do have less helium than the 1Bs. So those are the early time spectra. At late times, the differences are perhaps even more dramatic, especially among the type 1s. The type 2s, of course, always show hydrogen. But the 1As at late times become dominated by forbidden transitions from iron group elements, mostly iron, some cobalt, depending on just how old the thing is. Whereas the 1Bs and 1Cs look vastly different from 1As at late times. Instead of having the iron group elements, they are dominated by intermediate mass elements, the calcium, the oxygen, things like that. In fact, they basically look like type 2s, but without the hydrogen. And that's a big clue that the 1Bs and 1Cs are probably the type 2 mechanism, but without the hydrogen envelope. Okay, that's a major clue. All right, well, the other clues come from not just the spectra, but also the homogeneity and heterogeneity of the light curves in spectra, and also the environments in which we find these objects. The 1As are quite homogeneous in their light curves and in their spectra. And they're basically radio quiet, which suggests that the surroundings of the exploding star have very little circumstellar material with which the ejecta can interact. Okay? Again, suggesting a fairly old system, not perhaps really old in some cases, but fairly old, one that's fairly swept clear of other material. And moreover, the 1As are found in all Hubble types, including in elliptical galaxies. Galaxies which show very little evidence for recent star formation. And they're not clearly concentrated in spiral arms. There's some debate right now whether there's at least a bit of a concentration toward spiral arms, but they're not clearly concentrated in arms. Whereas the 2s and the 1BCs come from a very young stellar population. They are never seen in elliptical galaxies, and basically never in the bulges of spiral galaxies, but rather in the disks of spirals and in the arms and in irregular galaxies, starbursty galaxies. So again, the environmental evidence suggests that 1Bs and 1Cs come from a similar population to that which produces the type 2s. Let me, however, mention the 1As just in passing, because although we think that they are produced, well, we're certain they're produced by an exploding white dwarf of some sort, we don't know how that white dwarf gets to the explosive stage. And the basic idea is that you either have a single degenerate collecting material from some sort of a star, a subgiant or a main sequence star, or perhaps even a giant star. But then there's also this double degenerate idea where you have two white dwarfs that merge. This has the advantage that these systems are naturally very deficient in hydrogen, whereas these are not, and there's some debate, if 1As come from these kinds of systems, why haven't we detected any signs of hydrogen yet? So these are perhaps preferable. On the other hand, the most recent calculations suggest that when the less massive and hence bigger degenerate gets tidally disrupted by the more massive guy, it forms a thick disk around the more massive guy, which then accretes at a fairly hefty rate onto the more massive guy. If that accretion rate exceeds a few by 10 to the minus 6 solar masses per year, then what the calculations suggest is that you tend to get carbon oxygen burning into the star, the remaining white dwarf, which produces an oxygen neon magnesium white dwarf, and electron capture onto the magnesium then can lead to collapse of that white dwarf, producing perhaps a neutron star. So this is both a problem for the 1A supernova scenario and perhaps another way of producing neutron stars. So those of you who are interested in comparing the number density of neutron stars in our galaxy with the observed rate of core collapse supernovae, you may not be including the whole picture, because these are not considered core collapse supernovae, yet they may lead to neutron stars. And they're a thorn in the side of the 1A people, because this was initially a promising looking mechanism, which is now looking like it's not so promising anymore. But anyway, when you compare rates of supernovae with number densities of neutron stars, do not forget that this process might produce some of the neutron stars you're observing. And indeed, this is possibly the way in which planets around neutron stars are formed, because the disk that's formed preceding the accretion-induced collapse could coalesce into the planets that are seen around one or two pulsars. That's perhaps a more reasonable mechanism than planets forming after a bona fide, you know, supernova explosion. Okay, that's all about 1As. No more about 1As. Let me get now back to the core collapse guys. Adam already thoroughly discussed the core collapse mechanism and its aftermath. Let me just remind you that the reason this is somewhat encouraging, that the type 2s have such a large variety among their light curves and their spectra, is that we actually expect massive stars near the ends of their lives to have to span a wide variety of configurations. They can be red supergiants, and they can be blue supergiants, possibly because of the metallicity of their gas, or perhaps due to previous mergers. They can have lots of circumstellar material, they can have not much circumstellar material, so there can be a range of radio properties, there can be a range of optical light curve shapes depending on how much material the ejecta are colliding with. The more material there is, the more the kinetic energy of the ejecta is thermalized and radiated. So the diversity of type 2s is well explained by the hypothesis that they come from very massive stars. And of course, that hypothesis was beautifully, beautifully confirmed in the case of 87A, where the neutrino burst was seen, showing that a neutron star formed at least temporarily. The products of explosive nucleosynthesis were seen, 0.07 solar masses of nickel. And the progenitor clearly was an evolved massive star. Its initial mass was probably somewhere around 20 solar masses. And it experienced some, but not a huge amount of mass loss prior to that. Clearly there was some, because you see these rings. Since then, of course, we've not seen great evidence of the neutron star, although I note that there's a paper that I've not yet had a chance to read by Middleditch and gang claiming a 2.1 millisecond pulsar, yet again, in the ejecta, or in the innards of 87A. I don't know, has anyone looked at that paper closely, and does it bear, you know, should I spend my time on it, basically? It's old news, it's old data. It was published in August, but he sent around this email to everyone in the universe saying, look at my paper, so suggest to me I should take a look at it. Right, Right. Anyway, well, okay, we can talk about them offline. 87A, of course, is not the only star which gives us good evidence that we're on the right track in believing that massive stars give rise to core collapse supernovae and neutron stars, and perhaps in some cases, black holes. Here's just one example of a type II supernova, 1979C, whose environment we've observed with the Hubble Space Telescope, and basically making a color magnitude diagram of this cluster within which the supernova is embedded, and fitting theoretical isochrones leads us to the conclusion that the progenitor of this star was a 17 to 18 solar mass star, if it was part of this cluster and coeval and all that, which seems like an eminently reasonable assumption. Okay, so here's another object, basically, where we pretty much know it was a type II and it was a massive progenitor. Okay, so type II, there's no argument about. What about the 1Bs and Cs? Most of you, I'm sure, know the conventional wisdom now that they are thought to be core collapse objects, but let me just give you the reasons for that, all right? It is not totally crazy to think of them as being white dwarf, as having white dwarf progenitors that come near the upper mass range of objects that could form white dwarfs. If they came from, for example, 7 to 8 solar mass stars, then they too would be associated with fairly young stellar populations and stuff. So this is not a priori an unreasonable idea. And ways in which you might have a white dwarf go off in a 1BC-like way is if you, for example, had the off-center detonation of a carbon-oxygen white dwarf which has accreted helium onto its surface. You get a burning front, a detonation which goes outwards like this, and you compress the carbon-oxygen core to some extent by an inward wave, and then you get an off-center burning front starting from this carbon-oxygen core, and you basically blow the whole thing apart. And, you know, so this might do it, and Branching Nemoto had an early model of this sort. The problem is you get entirely the wrong spectrum from this kind of an explosion. The outward detonation of the helium layer produces a nickel and helium rich mixture moving at very high velocity. And instead, in 1Bs, you have, you know, intermediate mass elements at high velocity. And so you just don't get the right spectrum. So that's why we throw out this model. Stan Woosley and gang had the idea that maybe supernovae 1Bs and 1Cs are very slow deflagrations of white dwarfs. And that model still is alive, I think, to some degree, but has problems reproducing in detail the light curves and the spectra of 1Cs. So though the model is not completely dead yet, I think that the observational evidence against it is reasonably strong. The implications of this are important. We really need to know whether it's white dwarfs that are producing 1Bs and Cs or massive core collapse objects, because that obviously has implications for the expected rate of neutrino bursts in our galaxy, the chemical evolution of galaxies, and the birth rate of neutron stars. So it is an important question to answer. So let's go then and see how the conventional wisdom was decided upon. Iron core collapse, basically a type II without its clothes. This explains a lot of the observed characteristics, the association with young stellar populations, the nearly same distribution of distances from H2 regions as in the case of type II supernovae. The fact that you see helium in 1Bs and not in 1Cs, that could be just at different degrees of mass loss from the progenitor, either through winds of its own or through accretion onto a companion star. So all these things are good. They're less luminous than 1As, which also would be the case, because being core collapse objects, if they indeed are, they produce considerably less nickel 56 than the thermonuclear 1As, and it's that nickel which drives the late time light curve. So this is all looking pretty good. And then the question is, how do you lose the mass? Is it through winds of your own or through transfer to a companion? I'll have more to say about that later. If you rely on winds of the star's own creation, then you actually decrease the number of progenitors, because unless you have a very metal-rich population, the winds are thought to be not terribly effective in low Z populations, and so you might not have enough progenitors. So I actually think that transfer onto a companion is the more likely case in most cases, and I'll give evidence for that. One of the first bits of evidence really tying the core collapse mechanism to the 1Bs and 1Cs was this interesting supernova, 1987K, which was observed to be a classic type 2 early on. And I had a long observing run actually to observe SS-433, but occasionally I would sneak in an observing run, an observation of a supernova. And I noticed that it wasn't behaving the same way as normal type 2s. The H-alpha line wasn't growing in intensity, as is the case in most normal type 2s. It was staying about the same. Moreover, a little tiny notch was developing here, which may or may not have been real. Anyway, I then had to stop observing this thing because it's in the Virgo cluster, and the Virgo cluster is tough to observe from the ground, from the Earth, anywhere in our vicinity, much past mid-August. But I kept an eye on this guy mentally, and I said, I'm going to reobserve him when he comes out from behind the sun in December. So I was actually observing on Christmas Eve, which they no longer do at Lick Observatory because it's bad for the morale of the staff. But back then they did, and I got this wonderful Christmas present. The thing had turned into the spectrum of a 1B and a 1C. That is, it had no late-time hydrogen emission, whereas all previously observed type 2s had had a blazing hydrogen line at late times. You have a thick hydrogen envelope, there's no real way to get rid of that hydrogen. So the idea here is that you had a star that had lost most, but not all, of its hydrogen on the way to becoming a denuded core of a massive star. And you had a low mass, not necessarily thin in physical scale, but a low mass hydrogen envelope, which was visible shortly after shock breakout. But then as the recombination front moved down into the star and you exposed the deeper, heavier elements, you basically were dominated in the spectrum by those heavy elements, the calcium, the oxygen, things like that, and the hydrogen all but disappeared. So that was the idea. Fortunately, in 1993, we had a much better observed case of the same phenomenon. Supernova 1993J in M81 was a beautifully observed object from many observatories, and its early light curve already gave indications that it was not a normal type 2, despite having a normal type 2 spectrum at early times. Its light curve came down quickly, as would be expected. This is the original blast when the shock wave breaks through the envelope. You heat the surface of the star to 100,000 degrees or something, creating huge luminosities. They quickly go down as the thing adiabatically expands. But then normal supernovae flatten out like this as the shock deposited energy starts leaking out of the thick hydrogen envelope as the recombination front goes seeping through 10 solar masses or whatever. This is a normal type 2 plateau, whereas 93J went down, was just disappearing from sight actually for a while, then came back up very quickly, came back down, and then started an exponential decline. Well, Ken Nomoto and gang and others, Stan Woosley, predicted really that this should be an object with a very small hydrogen envelope, because otherwise there's no way to explain this early light curve. And I should remark that much later we found that the decay was faster than that of a canonical type 2, again suggesting that the envelope was thin and you did not have complete trapping of the gamma rays and the X-rays and stuff produced by the radioactive core of the star. So this suggested a thin envelope as well. Well, so Nomoto actually came out with a paper that predicted that this thing should transform itself into a 1B supernova. And just at the time that we were doing, that he came out with this paper, we actually were making observations at Lick Observatory on April 30th, which showed notches developing in the hydrogen line, a much more convincing notch than was the case in 87K. And that notch 2 weeks later became a very, very strong notch, and other notches, not so obvious, were visible as well. And they're all beautifully correlated with the helium sequence seen in a classic type 1B supernova. So the hydrogen was beginning to disappear, or at least was not growing in any obvious way, and helium was beginning to appear, suggesting that, again, very quickly after the outburst of this thing, we were already peering all the way through the hydrogen envelope, seeing the helium envelope below it. So that was just wonderful, and we said that, well, gee, at late times, this thing should show very little, if any, hydrogen. And indeed, 7 months later, the spectrum looked essentially like that of a type 1b. It had a little bit of a shoulder here, which was still H-alpha. But with crummier signal-to-noise ratio, or without a careful look at the spectrum, someone who got a spectrum of 93J for the first time, late after it went off, would have said that's a type 1b supernova, not a type 2 supernova. Now, eventually, hydrogen did become quite strong, but this is because of the interaction of the ejecta with material that was surrounding the system and which had previously been lost from the progenitor star. So that's actually quite interesting. We actually are seeing the material that it lost. It didn't lose it all to a companion. Another bit of evidence that the 1Bs and 1Cs have lost a fair amount of material, and indeed that the 1Cs have lost more material than the 1Bs, is that if you look at the late time spectra, you notice an interesting trend. The type 2s have very narrow lines, well, relatively narrow for a supernova. The so-called 2Bs, these ones that have lost most but not all their hydrogen, if that interpretation is correct, have wider lines. The 1Bs have still wider lines, and the 1Cs have the widest lines of all, suggesting two things, possibly a combination. First of all, if the explosion energy is roughly constant, and I know, as Adam said, that there are indications that there's a bit of a variety of explosion energies, but to a first approximation, they're roughly equal. So if you have the same explosion energy, but a smaller mass in the 1Cs, then the energy per unit mass is bigger and you tend to have higher ejection velocities. The other point is that these inner layers, which we're seeing at late times, are not damped by the big envelope of hydrogen that normally exists in a type 2. So this suggests that the 1Cs really do have less mass than the 1Bs, and that the reason we don't see helium, or at least much helium in the 1Cs, is that they just don't have it, rather than the competing hypothesis that the helium is present in the same abundance in 1Cs as 1Bs, but we simply don't see it because the nickel has not been mixed into the helium envelope and is not present to excite the helium into these rather bizarre levels from which the transitions occur. The other interesting thing is that the oxygen 1-7774 absorption is stronger in the early time spectra of 1Cs than 1Bs, suggesting once again that not only the hydrogen, but even much of the helium envelope has basically been gotten rid of in the case of the progenitors of the 1Cs. So I would say the evidence is pretty darn good that the 1Bs and 1Cs are close cousins of the type 2s, but simply come from the stripped envelope, the stripped stars. In most cases, I actually think that the loss of hydrogen is due to transfer onto a binary. One reason being that these 1Bs and 1Cs are actually fairly common things, and there, I think, aren't enough sufficiently massive stars for them to do it on their own. Moreover, in the case of 93J, we can actually see the progenitor star. There are photographs of M81 that show the progenitor star. It was a K0 supergiant. Its luminosity is suggestive of a 4 solar mass helium core. That could not probably have come from a 35 or a 40 solar mass object, unless you had some sort of anomalous winds that got rid of much of the helium core as well. So this was a relatively low mass star, somewhere in the range of 12 to 20 solar masses, probably 15. And a normal 15 solar mass star simply cannot lose its envelope on its own through winds, but can by transfer to a companion. All right. So most researchers think that most of these guys are actually probably losing their envelopes on their way to becoming, really, actually, the progenitors of high-mass X-ray binaries. Because the companion star may have been fairly massive to begin with, and it's just gained a truckload of material from the star that eventually became the supernova. And the star that became a supernova is presumably now a neutron star, or perhaps a black hole. And later on, then, accretion can produce a high-mass X-ray binary. It is interesting that some of these 1Cs show such large line widths that the associated energies, the suggested energies, are huge. They're called hypernovae. Some people call them that. Peculiar 1Cs, whatever. They have light curves that indicate a lot of energy and line widths that indicate a lot of energy. And at least in a few cases, there has been tantalizing evidence with an association with gamma ray bursts. And the most famous example is supernova 1998 BW, which I think was indeed associated with GRB042598. But there are a few other cases where the evidence is not so compelling, but it's intriguing. For example, supernova 1999E had very broad lines, suggesting a very large bulk energy. It was a very luminous object, absolute magnitude -19.4 or bigger, more luminous, because it wasn't found at peak, it was found after peak. So this thing was more luminous than a 1A, had huge ejection velocities, okay? It was, interestingly, 4.8 degrees from a gamma ray burst. That should be enough time, thanks. The gamma ray burst position, admittedly, is uncertain with a 7-degree error box, but hopefully with HETI 2 we'll be in a lot better shape starting later this year, perhaps. And if we can really show that some gamma ray bursts are definitively associated with supernovae, I think that'll be a very, very exciting step in the field. I think already there's a fair amount of evidence, Stree's work and other people's work on these more conventional objects. So this one, I might add, did have hydrogen. So it wasn't technically a 1B or a 1C, but the profile and the nature of the hydrogen leads us to believe that it was produced by the interaction of the ejecta with material, hydrogen-rich material, that was still left over in the vicinity of the supernova prior to its actual explosion. Okay, well, that suggests that, especially if gamma ray bursts are anisotropic, that we should see some evidence for asymmetries in some of these supernovae. Moreover, we have other motivations. Supernova remnants are asymmetric. Pulsars have huge velocities in some cases. So we should see some evidence for asymmetries even in the explosions themselves. And the way to look for asymmetries in unresolved objects is to get polarimetry. If you have a spherical source whose atmosphere is electron scattering dominated, then the electric vectors will all pretty much cancel out. And in a spectrum or broadband polarimetry of this point source, you'll have net zero polarization. If, on the other hand, the thing is oblate, then the electric vectors don't all cancel. If you could resolve this thing, you would actually see all these vectors, or you could see their presence, the implications of their being present. But in an unresolved source, all we can hope for is the net polarization. So spectropolarimetry can be used to look for asymmetries. And it is very intriguing that 93J, one of these 2B supernovae, was in fact polarized by a fair amount. On average, something like 0.6%. Actually, here's the percent right there. It's more like 0.8, even 1%. This thing was heftily polarized. And a 1% broadband polarization suggests, this is model dependent, but it suggests something like a 20 or 30% asymmetry in the major axis divided by the minor axis of the event. This could not have been a spherical event. And in some models, you can get even bigger asymmetries. Now, an interesting preliminary trend based on work done by the Texas group and also my own group at Berkeley to some extent is that as you go from type 2 to type 2b to 1b and 1c supernovae, that is, as you look at supernovae which for other reasons we think have had progressively more mass loss, you tend to see more and more evidence for asymmetry through these polarized spectra. The type 2s are hardly polarized at all. The 2b is polarized quite a bit. The 1bs and 1cs appear to be even more polarized. And in an interesting recent development, one of my students, Doug Leonard, observed the normal type 2 supernova 1999 EM and found that at early times it was not much polarized, but as you look deeper into the core, it became progressively more and more polarized, suggesting once again that it is the cores of core collapse objects that are asymmetrical, that are aspherical, either by rotation or asymmetric ejection or whatever. But the outer envelopes start approximating sphericity more and more. We need to do a lot more supernovae to see this. Almost done, Mars. So finally, let me just say something about rates, because everyone here wants to know how many objects are going to form type neutron stars and stuff. Rates are notoriously difficult to determine because no single supernova survey has discovered enough supernovae in a sufficiently uniform way with enough knowledge of the selection criteria and all that to be able to form a good discussion of rates as a function of Hubble type. So the best that's been done is by Enrico Capellaro last year, where he combined 5 very different surveys. One, a visual search by the Reverend Evidence, who has a direct line to God somehow. And the others were a variety of photographic plate searches, which are terrible in terms of many of their selection effects. Nevertheless, this is the best that's been done. But beware, and just use these numbers as a rough guideline. So here are the results. You don't have to copy them, because this is going to be on the web. Plus, you can look at Capellaro's paper. But the bottom line is that spiral galaxies, the late-type spirals, are the ones, as we've known for a long time, that tend to produce a lot of core collapse events. And the SBCs to SDs in total produce about 1 SNU. 1 supernova unit is 1 supernova per century per 10 billion blue solar luminosities. Now, what a crazy, archaic astronomical unit this is. But, you know, along the lines of magnitudes, what do you expect from us, all right? This is actually not so bad. All we really need to know to answer the question following Adam's talk is, what is this rate and what is the blue luminosity of our Milky Way galaxy? We don't know it very well. I believe it's somewhere between 2 and 3 of these units. And so Adam's number of 1 per 50 or 30 years is the way we get that, okay? So that's the idea, all right? And the 1BC rate is something like 1/6 of the core collapse guys. Now, just one more view graph. We hope within a few years to be able to do this in a much more rigorous way. We have a supernova search that's done in a very systematic way at Lick Observatory, done with a robotic telescope. And a postdoc, Weidong Li, is in charge of that. We discovered 20 supernovae in 1998, 40 in 99. We're well on our way to roughly reaching this number, not quite, this year. So within a few years, we'll actually have our own sample of 100 to 150 supernovae, all discovered the same way, all with CCD images of the galaxies, so we know when they went off, we know the control times, we can remove the times when they were behind the sun and all that stuff. And so we should be able to, in a systematic way, have, you know, a more reliable set of supernova rates. Not yet with very small error bars, because our sample is only 100 supernovae, but maybe in 10 years we'll even have small error bars. But at least we'll be systematic and we won't have these systematic uncertainties floating in that you get from photographic and visual surveys. Okay, that's about it. Thanks. You can look up that web page if you want.
Questions? George? And repeat the question, Alex.
So. Yeah, I will. Mm-hmm. I'm used to it in Astro 10.
The polarization by this angle shows some dependence on the wavelengths.
Yes. Yeah, for electron scattering, you don't expect any dependence on the wavelength. Let's see, that's the wrong one. The previous one. That just shows that polarization is a function of time. Here it is, polarization is, yeah. Well, the thing is, you get rotations in the polarization position angle within features, okay, within spectral features. So for example, the P Cygni absorption is produced in a very well understood way in a type 2. I have the sheet of paper, but not the thing. Anyway, the P Cygni absorption, as you know, is formed by gas that's between us and the continuum source. And here it is. And what happens is that in this absorption here, you actually tend to get an increase in the polarization, okay? Because you've got less diluting unpolarized continuum along that line of sight. You're pretty much seeing down deep into the supernova there, and you have less of the diluting continuum that you would get through multiple scatterings in the other regions. Multiple scatterings tend to kill polarization. So a prediction that McCall and others made long ago was that the polarization would indeed be higher within deep absorption troughs. And in general, for example, you can see that. Here's an absorption trough, and it's got an increase in polarization. Here's another one, it's got an increase. And you have a rotation and a position angle as well, because again, you then have to consider the geometry and from where are the photons coming. So I don't claim to understand the details of this graph yet, but the fact that you have rotation in polarization position angle is reasonably well understood. Sri?
Of this rates that you quoted, are they corrected for the fact that the different kinds of supernovae have, you know, more or less good luminosity compared to, let's say, the 1X?
Yeah, these are correct. The question is, are these corrected for the different luminosities? And some attempt has been made to do that. But the trouble, for example, with the photographic searches is that many of them are overexposed throughout much of the galaxy. And the core collapse supernovae being less luminous than the 1As means that the contrast is worse, and they also are often in the more complicated environments. So when I said beware there, I should have put it in giant box. I personally don't trust these rates to better than a factor of 2, roughly, 2 or 3. But at least it tells you, as Adam said, that we don't expect a core collapse supernova every 6 years in our galaxy. But it might be as bad as every 100 years. But 30 to 50, you won't bet, you know, you won't lose too much money with that kind of a bet. Anyway, stay tuned in a few years, Sri. Yeah.
You mentioned that 87A and 93J had progenitors identified. Are there any
other? Yes. Yeah, there are actually a few supernovae with identified progenitors. And Brian, I'm glad you asked me that question, because I left this out of my talk. There's a few that have very luminous progenitors. Here's one, supernova 1997BS. It was actually the first one that we had found in our survey. And you might have thought, even from the name, that its integrity as a supernova should be questioned. It has a progenitor. Again, I have the sheet of paper, but not the view graph. We can see it in Hubble Space Telescope images taken prior to the explosion. Here it is. There's a HST image taken in 1994, which quick calculation will tell you was before 1997. It has an absolute magnitude of -7.4. We believe it was a luminous blue variable which underwent a super outburst of the Eta Carinae type. And the star is still visible now, several years later, because basically it survived the explosion. The explosion itself was not a true explosion. It was about a factor of 100 fainter than usual ones. And so we actually think that something like 5% of the observed type 2s and a greater fraction of the lowest luminosity ones are imposters. They are massive stars near the ends of their lives, but they have not yet died. And so we found the progenitor of this guy, also of 61V and a few others. Most of those cases are these imposters. 87A and 93J are the only two true supernovae of type 2 that I know of which have had identified progenitors. And there's a comment back there. Yes?
Are there any radio detections for any imposters?
I'm sorry, I didn't.
Are there any radio detections?
Yeah, there are. There are some radio detections. And these massive luminous blue variables should be sort of shedding their skin to some degree. And there was definitely an ejection of material in the super outburst, and you might expect it to interact. So, you know, I'm not sure exactly why you want, did you want them to be, or did you not want them to be radio, or did you not care? Anyway, 93J and 87A are the only true ones, we think, with identified secure progenitors. The others are all imposters.
Is there no way you can measure the ejected mass so as to rule out the white dwarf model for 1Ds and 1Cs?
Yeah, let me just put that one back on in case you wanted to see that. Yeah, there are ways of measuring the ejected mass. For example, we have tried to measure the mass of emitting oxygen from line ratios, line intensity ratios of the oxygen 1 lines. And indeed, we actually find too small a mass in ejected oxygen to be compatible with an 8 solar mass helium core that produced a lot of oxygen. Similarly, the light curves can be used to constrain the mass of the ejecta. If the light curves are too broad, then the gamma rays get trapped a lot, converted to X-rays. Even those X-rays get trapped, and most of the radiated energy then becomes thermalized. Most of the radioactive decay energy becomes thermalized. And indeed, one of the early arguments against a Wolf-Rayet origin for most of the 1Bs and 1Cs was that their light curves, to a first approximation, resemble those of 1As. That is, an object with at most one or two solar masses, maybe three, of ejected stuff. Because if there were more stuff, you would have broader light curves. So there's a number of arguments against the hypothesis that most of these things are the denuded cores of extremely massive stars. Don?
Going back to the spectral.
Yes.
How much this polarization can be attributed to
environmental? Oh, yes. Okay, so there are a number of objects where, and I didn't bring the view graph, but there are a number of objects where, the question is, how much of the polarimetry can be attributed to environmental effects? And indeed, we have one object that we've studied in great detail, supernova 1998S. Didn't bring it. Almost all of its polarization, we think, is attributed to an interaction with a disk-like environment, much like that of 87A, but a lot denser and closer in to the progenitor. So it has one of these rings, we think, and the ejecta started interacting with the ring right away. The way you can kind of tell is, for example, in that object, we actually see double peaked lines from the ejecta suggesting a flattened disk-like configuration. We can also tell, to some extent, from which lines are the polarized ones and how much does the polarization vary with time and how does it compare with the continuum. All these sort of things can be analyzed to try to determine whether it's mostly circumstellar or mostly the ejecta themselves. It's complicated. In this case, we actually think it was mostly the ejecta themselves. And the reason is that, unlike the case of 98S and a few others, where there was radio evidence and other evidence for a prompt interaction of the ejecta with junk surrounding the ejecta, here in 93J, the thing initially exploded in a vacuum. There was very little radio emission. There was very little other indications of interaction of the ejecta with circumstellar material. So when there's no other evidence for interaction, yet the polarization is 1% like this, then we feel fairly confident that we are seeing asymmetries in the ejecta. And that, coupled with this more detailed analysis that I was mumbling about a minute ago, provides a fairly self-consistent story. But if you see radio and other UV evidence for immediate interaction, then you have to be much, much more careful, because you could be just seeing the geometry of the circumstellar material.
Great. Well, let's thank Alex one more time.
Thank you.